Deadlines. Atari Amir Sheikh Tamim is in Tehran on a one-day state visit for talks with President Raisi. Palestinians pay tribute to veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli occupation forces while reporting an army raid. And a new report sheds light on hundreds of Native American children who died of various forms of abuse and punishment at U.S. state-run boarding schools. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: a short while ago, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially welcomed Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani at the Sadabad complex in Tehran. Sheikh Tamim is paying a one-day state visit to Iran's capital at the head of a high-ranking political and economic delegation. President Ebrahim Raisi and visiting Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani were just holding a joint press conference. In the closing statements of the press conference, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi highlighted once again the importance of the Qatari Emir's visit in the expansion of bilateral ties and cooperation. Of course, we're going to keep you posted on the details of the Qatari Emir's visit to Iran and much more. Meetings with other senior Iranian officials have also been scheduled. The visit comes in response to a trip by President Raisi to Doha 3 months ago. The enhancement of bilateral ties as well as major regional and international issues of concern will be at the heart of the discussions. Sheikh Tamim last visited Tehran in January 2020. Senior geopolitical advisor Alexander Ozadegan says the Qatari Emir's trip to Tehran is a positive step in promoting mutual relations.
This has been the strategic goal of Iran for several years now. Iran wants the U.S. out of the Persian Gulf. But the problem is that the region's biggest military base happens to be in Qatar, and Turkey is also there as well. Iran has always said that we should get together all these Persian Gulf countries and the Sea of Oman countries, that being Oman, obviously. Let's get together. Let's not bring foreigners into this place. Now, China really wants to get into the Persian Gulf region. That's another issue. But the Iranians, in my assessment, have been giving not just the Qataris, but the big country of Saudi Arabia, the green lights. Foreign Minister Dr. Zarif always said that Iran is under no illusion that Saudi Arabia should also play a leadership role in this area. Now, back to a question with the Iranian president. When you have the king of the Emir of Qatar visiting Tehran, that's basically an indication that all other negotiations are backed. Usually when they send in the dignitaries of the highest echelon, that means things for most part are have been negotiated positively, and the presence of his emiri, the Qatari emir in Tehran, or President Raisi in any of these other Persian Gulf countries is a good positive sign.
A state memorial service has been held at the presidential compound in Ramallah for a Palestinian journalist the day after Israeli forces killed her. A huge crowd of mourners paid their last respects to Shirin Abu Akleh, who was shot in the face by Israeli snipers while covering an army raid in Jenin on Wednesday. Her body lay in state at the compound as a host of officials, including President Mahmoud Abbas, as well as people from all walks of life, paid homage to the veteran journalist. The funeral service is scheduled for Friday. The murder of Abu Akleh has sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnations, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Israeli forces have killed a renowned international journalist in the occupied West Bank. Al Jazeera reporter Shirin Abu Akleh was shot dead on Wednesday. She was killed while reporting on an Israeli raid against Palestinians in the city of Jenin. Violence has surged in Jenin in recent weeks as Israeli forces have stepped up operations in the area after a spate of deadly retaliatory attacks targeting Israelis. Abu Akleh was a very well-respected journalist who has been working with Al Jazeera since the beginning of the Second Palestinian Intifada in 2000.
And the shooting of this journalist is just to cover up their crimes, to show what they were, to not allow the people of the world to see the kinds of things they were doing with this raid in Jenin and many other instances. They didn't only kill this journalist, but they wounded a second journalist.
The Palestinian Health Ministry also said another journalist sustained a gunshot wound to the back. The Associated Press said the Palestinian journalist working for the Al-Quds newspaper was in stable condition. The International Federation of Journalists has described the killing as a deliberate, systematic targeting of a journalist and is planning to submit the case to the International Criminal Court. Yet again, journalists wearing press vests clearly identified were targeted by Israeli snipers. We will seek to add this case to the ICC complaint submitted by the IFJ detailing such systematic targeting. And the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate has decried Abu Akleh's death as a clear assassination perpetrated by the Israeli occupation army.
And they killed this journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, by shooting her in the face. That's just a terrible thing to do. They didn't have to do anything like that. It's a brutal way of acting. It doesn't show any care to human life. It is a very a terrible thing, and it needs to be condemned by the whole world.
Iran has also harshly condemned the killing, saying the case highlights Israel's brutal treatment towards journalists and media outlets.
This is not the first time that a Palestinian reporter has been killed by Israeli forces. During the March of Return protests that were held in 2018 and 19, Palestinian journalists were regularly targeted to prevent them from reporting the Israeli gunfire towards fellow Palestinians. Time and time again, Israeli forces have killed Palestinian civilians, including journalists and medics, without cause, and they do that with impunity as if they were above international law.
Meanwhile, a Qatari official has harshly lashed out at Israel over the incident, calling for an end to, quote, state-sponsored Israeli terrorism. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas condemned in the strongest terms what it called the premeditated murder. It said the world and all international institutions must condemn the heinous crime against the press and free speech and hold the Israeli regime accountable. It further noted that this crime will not succeed in preventing the role of the media and free journalists in conveying the truth, the reality of the Israeli occupation, its brutality, terrorism, and the crimes against the Palestinian people, land, and holy sites.
There's going to be a lot of anger among Palestinians, and there will be more conflict and more fighting because of it, and there will probably be some resistance that will be met very harshly by Israel, which is financed to a large extent and given a lot of military aid by the United States. So they have weapons that Palestinians can't in any way match.
Yet Israel has another belief on what has occurred. The Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has said, according to the information we have gathered, it appears likely that armed Palestinians who were firing indiscriminately at the time were responsible for the unfortunate death of the journalist. In a statement, Al Jazeera called on the international community to hold Israeli forces accountable for the intentional targeting and killing of its journalist.
But it's not the only thing. There is right now a case that has been filed with the International Criminal Court against Israel for the shooting of four journalists in this past year alone. And Israel has actually shot 46 journalists since the year 2000. So this is just the continuation of a brutal policy.
This is not the first time Israel has killed a journalist. The regime systematically targets Palestinian journalists, and with the deliberate killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, Israel has now killed over 45 Palestinian journalists since the year 2000.
A new report shows more than 500 Native American children have died in U.S. government-run boarding schools over a period of more than a century. The Department of Interior's report says indigenous children were exposed to physical abuse, food denial, and other forms of punishment. In state-run boarding schools, it says the school system pursued the twin goals of cultural assimilation and territorial dispossession of indigenous peoples through relocation of their children. The study identified more than 400 such schools operating in the U.S. for 1.5 centuries, starting in the early 19th century. There are also more than 50 marked or unmarked burial sites. The deaths of 500 indigenous students were attributed to only 19 schools that have been investigated so far. The department says further investigation may increase the number of student deaths to thousands or even tens of thousands. Finland is expediting its plans to join NATO. The country says it will apply for membership without delay. President Sauli Niinisto and Prime Minister Sanna Marin have said in a statement that the national steps needed to make the decision will be taken rapidly. Over the next few days, a special committee will announce Finland's formal membership bid on Sunday. Foreign Minister Pekka Haavisto says Finland's accession to NATO will strengthen security in the Baltic Sea region. Sweden is also likely to follow suit. Sources inside the EU say NATO allies are expecting Finland and Sweden to be granted membership quickly. Russia has repeatedly warned the two European Union member states against the bid. It sees NATO enlargement as a direct threat to its own security. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen leveling some harsh criticism at Russia and calling it a big threat to international order.
And this brings me to Russia. It is today the most direct threat to the world order. With the barbaric war against Ukraine and its worrying pact with China and their call for new and very much arbitrary international relations.
The European Commission chief was speaking after meeting Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida along with European Council President Charles Michel. Kishida also said the Ukraine war is not just a matter that concerns Europe, but it shakes the core of the international order, including Asia. The top EU officials are in Tokyo for an annual round of talks that come with much of the international community rallying to pressure Moscow over the Ukraine war. A new poll shows that the average French person's life is being drastically impacted by runaway inflation. Coming after years of far-right economic austerity, the French economy now appears on the brink of major trouble. Rami Mazzari has more from Paris.
France is a nation of 67 million people, and 40 million of them earn less than 2,000 euros per month. A new poll reveals that skyrocketing inflation is wreaking unprecedented havoc on their lives. The poll says that after bills are paid, 20 million Frenchmen have less than 100 euros in the bank by the 10th of each month. It's not a new problem. Perhaps the primary slogan of the Yellow Vest movement has been a cry of the end of the month.
For us delivery drivers, the price of gas has put us in a very difficult condition. I spent almost 60% more on petrol than I used to, and every day now. Of course, it's not just petrol. Everything else has gotten more expensive too. The state has to lower taxes.
A stunning 95% of those earning less than 2,000 euros per month are worried about inflation. Two-thirds say they are struggling to get by. Half say they have insomnia over financial worries. And 80% of households with children fear they will fall into poverty.
Everything is more expensive, and all my friends and I talk about it. Even the cost of something basic, like cooking oil, has gotten dramatically more expensive. We hope things will somehow get better, but for now, things are quite tight.
New official data says prices will jump 5.4% in June, in the largest monthly increase since 1985. The next 2 months will also see further increases and combined with near-recession levels of economic growth. After years of no-strings-attached quantitative easing and zero-interest-rate policies for the rich, interest rates are now being hiked just when the average person most needs some credit. The failure to invest years of this so-called free money into societally productive investments means the real economy has suffered from long-running neglect at the expense of high finance, real estate, and stocks. Deeply unpopular austerity cuts have also worsened the condition of the real economy, put even more costs on the average person's back, and left France poorly equipped for what seems like the latest Western financial crisis. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Japan and South Korea say the North has fired three ballistic missiles into the sea off its east coast. The South Korean military said the short-range missiles were fired from the Sunan area in Pyongyang towards the Sea of Japan. The Japanese Coast Guard also confirmed a projectile believed to be a ballistic missile had fallen outside Japan's territorial waters. The launch is estimated to be North Korea's 16th weapons test so far this year. In recent weeks, Pyongyang has announced plans to build up its arsenal. North Korea has even spoken of a potential preemptive nuclear strike to counter hostile forces. Pyongyang says its nuclear and missile program is for self-defense against threats spearheaded by Washington in the region. Britain's economy is teetering on the brink of recession amid soaring inflation. The country's official data shows the economy contracted by 0.1% in March. Following a zero growth in February, the UK economy also grew 0.8% overall in the first 3 months of the year. The country's finance minister blames repercussions of the Ukraine war as well as other global issues for the current circumstances in the UK. Meanwhile, the Bank of England has forecasted inflation could rise more than 10% by the end of the year. Experts say price pressure will probably mean the bank will raise interest rates further to curb inflation, but still, the major source of concern for Britain's economy is the risk of recession. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another important point is that certain priorities must be considered for the expansion of knowledge-based companies. One of the priorities, which is very important, is that such companies should be after resolving the matter. We have specific economic issues in the country. These companies must engage in resolving these issues. They must be established on the basis of the needs. In other words, there should be a need-based criterion for these companies. There are certain areas on which economic security is dependent. For example, the area of agriculture. The other day, in my New Year's speech, I said that one of the most dependent areas on imports is the agriculture area. That is why agriculture is closely linked to our food security. This is an important issue. Regarding knowledge-based companies, we must take it into account that the economic security of the country is dependent on them, that they have a high capacity for employing non-working specialists, and that they can solve the problem related to the sale of raw materials such as mines. Unfortunately, we have lots of problems in the area of mines.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the problems is the sale of raw resources and materials. Let us exclude oil because we really have no value added in the case of oil, but in the case of gas, we have some value added. However, according to what experts say, it is possible to create a lot of value added in the area of oil if downstream oil areas receive attention. The same is true of gas and mines. There are many valuable and expensive metals and stones in the country. That is why there is no value added for them. They are exported without creating value added. These areas are important, and we must get knowledge-based companies to focus on these areas. Another point about knowledge-based production is that we should really support knowledge-based companies. Executive organizations should support them. The most important consumer of products in the country is the administration. Well, the administration can use knowledge-based products. When I have frequently spoken about preventing unnecessary imports, one example of it is to support these companies and their products.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On May 10, 2021, Israel began an offensive on the Gaza Strip that went on for 11 days. The regime razed several buildings in the meantime, including a tower housing the bureaus of several news outlets, including Al Jazeera's. The bombings killed over 250 Palestinians in the besieged enclave, including dozens of women and children. But this time, unlike other incidents where Israel launched attacks on the Strip, Palestinian resistance movements struck back hard, killing at least 12 Israelis.
We have to remember that while there have been deaths on both sides, the deaths of Palestinians far outnumber those of the Israelis, probably by close to 1,000 to 1. So there is not a lot of importance given to Palestinian lives. This has been an ongoing, long-standing policy of the world. It's completely unjust. It ignores international law and human rights, but this has been the case. But any efforts to bring rights to the Palestinians, rights that they are entitled to by international law simply because they live, because they exist, will be opposed because no other country wants to risk its economic ties with Israel.
The conflict had been in the making for several weeks prior, when Israeli troops intensified their crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The protests that had erupted at the regime's attempt to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah also escalated tensions. The devastating conflict ended in an Egypt-brokered ceasefire that went into effect on May 21st. The battle, however, significantly altered the perceptions about the military capabilities of Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The 2021 confrontation is widely hailed as a victory for Hamas and other resistance movements in Gaza, not only militarily and on the ground, but also morally on an international level. Demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood were held across the world. A wider and more diverse group of people around the globe called for an end to the conflict and Israel's aggression, which helped raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians to a much higher extent.
Israeli invisibility can mean a number of things. You're referring to militarily, but there's also the invincibility that it had for so many years as being seen as the victim, the innocent victim just trying to defend itself. That has certainly been shattered. People around the world, even if they support Israel, see Israel as the aggressor.
A year on, Tel Aviv is once again intensifying the pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli forces and settlers have repeatedly raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound over the past few weeks, a location that's considered Islam's third holiest site. In response, there has been a spike in the number of deadly Palestinian retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. Palestinians say the attacks are a natural response to Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa, an issue they warn is their red line. The mounting tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are raising fears about another confrontation. But the events over the past couple of years have indicated that Palestinians will continue to fight for what they believe in and that they can inflict pain on the other side, too.
Europe's largest economy, Germany, is going through a historic phase. Inflation rates have risen sharply, reaching a 40-year high, with soaring energy prices being the key driving force. According to the German Federal Statistics Agency, the Statist, consumer prices were about 7.5% higher in April compared to last year. Berlin also faces an imminent recession in case of a gas supply cut from Russia. The latest remarks by the chief executive officer of a major commercial bank in Germany have increased concerns inside the country. Manfred Knopf has warned that the energy supply in Germany is at risk, which may lead to the spread of bankruptcies in the country. Quoted by a German business newspaper, Knopf said the energy supply is at risk. Supply chains are breaking in addition to high inflation in the country. He also warned that bankruptcies in German markets are probably going to increase. According to the executive, almost a third of Germany's foreign trade has been impacted as well. Germany is facing soaring energy prices and a skyrocketing inflation due to the imposition of sanctions on Russia to pressure Moscow into ending the war in Ukraine. The measures mainly affected the financial sector and the supply of high-tech products. The real crisis in Germany lies in the Russian gas, on which it depends to a large extent. Berlin was one of the opponents within the EU to ban the import of Russian gas, but the scenario changed completely after it announced recently its readiness to accept an immediate ban on Russian oil and gas supplies. According to Forbes, Germany is one of the largest customers of Russian oil, and Berlin depends on a third of its Russian oil imports, 45% of its coal purchases, and 55% of its gas imports from Russia. Economists believe the immediate suspension of Russian energy imports would cause a severe recession in Germany.
The EU is not allowed to stop. This is what Washington ordered, and Washington orders the EU around. And the crazy situation right now is that Washington was never as powerful as it is today. This is especially funny since the American president is a weak president. So obviously somebody else is inserting this pressure into the EU from Washington, and I think that is the American deep state pushing Joe Biden and the EU, both of them. And as long as nobody stops this kind of power wielding, it will continue.
The Russia-Ukraine war is not comparable to any other war in history due to its geoeconomic significance. Both Ukraine and Russia are leading exporters of commodities such as crude, natural gas, iron and steel, wheat and edible oils that have a direct impact on inflation levels in major world economies. The conflict pushed crude prices to over $130 per barrel. There were also price increases on wheat, edible oils, and other commodities. The unilateral sanctions of the West against Russia had the unintended consequence of exacerbated inflation in Europe, East Africa, and South Asia, which were the largest importers of Russian wheat and energy. Despite the detrimental effect of sanctions on global markets, the EU unveiled plans for a Russian oil embargo earlier this week. The measure is expected to come into force within 9 months, with the time frame varying for different petroleum products. But several EU nations, including Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, are seeking an exemption from the ban.
And of course, all these sanctions against Russia are completely unfair, unjustified, and for the first time, because we have 8th of May today, and for the first time since the Second World War, a German government is again siding with Nazis and again against Russia. And this really makes Moscow very angry, and the people too.
The founder of Brazil's Workers' Party, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who served as president for 2 terms from 2003 to 2011, has launched his presidential bid as Brazil's October 2022 presidential elections approach. Economic recovery is his campaign's main promise.
We need to put Brazil back among the best economies in the world.
In an address to his supporters in the city of Sao Paulo, Lula called for unity around democracy. He also stressed the importance of focusing on Brazil's sovereignty and environmental issues. He criticized the performance of incumbent president Jair Bolsonaro, calling his administration incompetent. Bolsonaro faces a tough challenge to win re-election against his political nemesis Lula. The latest polls indicate that Lula maintains a comfortable lead over Bolsonaro. Many Brazilians are angry at the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, rising inflation, and high fuel prices. Bolsonaro has been widely criticized for downplaying the coronavirus pandemic from the outset, opposing restrictive measures for fear of damaging the economy. Over 650,000 Brazilians have died of COVID-19. Lula had previously described the huge COVID-19 death toll under Bolsonaro's watch as genocide. In addition, the government's fiscal indiscipline and the prospect of double-digit inflation have prompted the central bank to increase interest rates by 5.75 percentage points since March. Now, Lula says if elected, he has grand plans for Brazil's economy. One of them is to free the country of the US dollar. Lula da Silva has proposed expanding Latin American economic integration through the creation of a common regional currency. Lula says Latin American countries should use a unified regional currency like the euro to end South America's inclination toward the US dollar and to do bilateral trade with each other instead of having to exchange for US dollars. Lula has also vowed to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The five countries represent 41% of the global population, 24% of the global gross domestic product, and 16% of the global trade. Lula da Silva has also vowed to bolster Brazil's relations with other regional countries.
Now that's important because still the US dollar is used for the vast majority of trade in Latin America, and internationally still about 70% of international transactions are done with the dollar. What that does is it strengthens the US economy and it weakens other currencies. So Lula da Silva is saying why are we continuing to do trade with each other using the U.S. government currency? Why don't we create our own currency to do trade with each other? And I think a lot of countries in the region think that's a very sensible policy.
The Bretton Woods Agreement was negotiated in July 1944 by delegates from 44 countries at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Under the Bretton Woods system, gold was the basis for the US dollar and other currencies were pegged to the US dollar's value. Since then, the US dollar has dominated global trade and financial market. But now Washington faces a tough challenge, and that's to keep the crown on US dollar's head as the leading global reserve or fiat currency. For many years, the dollar has been the standard currency used in world trade. The US dollar currently has enormous power to infect the global economy with US inflation and the impact of US interest rate rises, both of which are managed primarily for US domestic purposes. Add to it the economic sanctions the US has imposed against other countries to achieve ends that complement or replace military efforts. Venezuela and Cuba are among the Latin American countries that have been victims of the US sanctions regime. One of the consequences of sanctions is rising inflation levels. Hence, it's natural for these economies to seek ways to circumvent America's sanctions. For instance, since 2011, China gradually shifted from trading in US dollars in favor of trade in yuan. It made agreements with Australia, Russia, Japan, Brazil, and Iran to trade in national currencies. It has been reported that in the first quarter of 2020, the share of the dollar in the bilateral trade between China and Russia fell below 50% for the first time.
It's an objective fact that the dollar is becoming less powerful over time. Even the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is dominated by the United States, has acknowledged that the use of dollars in international central bank reserves has been decreasing. Now, it's decreasing slowly. It's not going to disappear overnight. But in decades, I think it's quite clear that the hegemony that we've seen of the US dollar dominating the international financial system is over.
Most economies are establishing different mechanisms to circumvent the US sanctions regime and the hegemony of the US dollar. These range from using barter trade to trading in their currencies over the dollar. The world is moving toward multipolarity, and the US is no longer the world's largest trading nation, it's China. Therefore, it's only a matter of time before the US dollar loses its dominance among global currencies.
At least three Israelis were killed and several others injured in the city of Elat on Thursday in an operation the Palestinian resistance groups hailed as a victory for the residents of the occupied Al-Quds. The incident took place on the day of Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe, marking the anniversary of Israel's eviction of Palestinians from their homeland and declaring its existence.
It was the event when 40% of the Palestinian population was expelled or killed or expelled from their homeland, Palestine, and expelled mostly going abroad to neighboring countries and even distant countries.
The operation took place after over 600 Israeli settlers raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under protection from the regime's forces. Over a dozen Palestinians were injured, and some 50 others, including the elderly and children, were arrested during raid. In a statement, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds is a red line and that the Elat operation reflects the Palestinian nation's wrath over repeated Israeli desecrations of their holy sites. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement termed the desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli forces and extremist Jewish settlers a declaration of war against the entire Palestinian nation, stating that Palestinians will continue to confront the occupiers and their aggression. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has practically turned into a period of escalating tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces' raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque culminated in an 11-day war between the regime and Gaza-based resistance groups in May last year, a conflict that killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. There has also been a recent surge in the number of Palestinian operations across the occupied territories over the past few weeks, raising fears that another war might be on the cards. The reactions to the mounting tensions have been particularly interesting. While many Western nations have kept silent about the developments, some, including US President Joe Biden, have been calling on both sides to avoid violence and exercise restraint. A parallel can be drawn with the war in Ukraine. Is anyone calling on Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms?
In a way, it's the same thing that is causing the United States to back the Ukrainians and to be against the Palestinians. It's the United States sees an advantage and in putting pressure on a potential rival to its power, in this case Russia. They decided that Israel is the power that could help them to achieve that dominance. So it's all about in effect the United States ruling the world.
The normalization of ties between some Arab states and Israel has made matters even worse for the people of Palestine, despite earlier promises that the establishment of relations would benefit their cause. The Palestinians have vowed to continue their resistance until their legitimate rights are acknowledged. If the developments over the past several decades are any indication, they will make good on their words.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Neighbors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that there is a lot of emphasis on the neighbors, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has emphasized on having a good relation with the neighbors. And also in many narrations, we have this, that the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they have emphasized about dealing goodly or having a good behavior with the neighbors. Whereas we can see, for example, like in the Quran, Allah, where it talks about the walidain or parents, there it also talks about وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا وَبِذِي الْقُرْبَى وَالْيَتَامَى وَالْمَسَاكِينَ وَالْجَارِ ذِي الْقُرْبَى وَالْجَارِ الْجُنُبِ وَالصَّاحِبِ بِالْجَنْبِ. So where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is saying that be good with your parents and your relatives and the orphans and the poor, there it also says that you need to be good with your neighbors who are on your side, the one who is from your relatives or the others who are next to you. So we need to pay attention to the topic of the neighbors if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle. Because without paying attention to the neighbors, we cannot have the good Islamic lifestyle. In the Islamic lifestyle, we need to pay attention to the rights of the people. And those who are living next to us, they are on the priority. And obviously, we need to look after their rights first, and then the rest of the society, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that in the Islamic teachings, in the Quran and the narrations, we see that there is a lot of emphasis on being good with the neighbors or having a good relation with our neighbors. And on the other hand, we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam has also emphasized in his will on having a good relation with the neighbors. And that was because of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said to have good relations. Therefore, this is something which we need to pay attention, that when we are living in a place, we should make sure that the other people who are next to us, they do not feel bad because of us, or they are not disturbed because of us. Even if we want to have some kind of, for example, guests coming in our house, we need to make sure that, for example, if they're parking their car, it should not be disturbing the others. Or maybe if we have the gathering, the voices should not be so loud, or the talking should not be so loud that the other neighbors are getting disturbed, especially if someone is living in the apartments, because in the apartments we have people living in a small compound, and obviously the disturbance do create when we have some guests. So we need to be very much careful when we are dealing with our neighbors, because the first people whom rights we need to look after our households are the neighbors. And it is the neighbors that if we are good with them, they will be good with us. And therefore, we can have an easy life and a happy life if we are the good neighbors and if we have the good neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
free territory.
Part 1.
During my childhood, the conquest of desert was a dream that took me on a vacation to Patagonia. 200 kilometers on a straight line through the province of La Pampa. Almost 150 years have passed since the Argentine Republic launched an offensive to expand its borders and dispose the indigenous people of their ancestral lands in the south part of the country. The conquest of the desert was not a trip. It was a campaign of extermination carried out by its two main protagonists, Julio Argentino Roca and Remington Rifles, who came from the United States. Julio Argentino Roca was a 35-year-old young general with a brilliant military career. In 1878, he was Minister of War and Navy. He was the intellectual and material author of the first genocide in the history of Argentina. While he was presenting his plans for the desert campaign to the assembly, he said, "We have 6,000 soldiers who are armed with the latest modern military inventions in order to fight against the 2,000 Indians who have no defense other than dispersion and no weapons other than the primitive spear." One of the most powerful indigenous chiefs of Patagonia was Modesto Encalao, a man who did not have a hostile policy towards the government of Argentina. He was deprived of his land, sent to prison, and later he was transferred to Buenos Aires. He was condemned to slavery in the last days of his life in the underground Museum of Natural Sciences of La Plata. Encalao was tormented and died far from his homeland. He spent long hours looking at the remains of his wife and loved ones that were exhibited by Perito Moreno as anthropological pieces in the museum. Those who saw him in the last days of his life described him as a ghost. The military soldiers had also stolen his children. Later, they gave the children to the families of the generals to work as their servants. Some reports point out that before his death, he ripped off the white man's clothes. Encalao had resisted declaring himself as Argentinian. His outraged body also remained as a museum piece for more than 100 years. At the beginning of the 21st century, many children from Patagonia wrote letters to the authorities of the La Plata Museum to ask them to return his remains to the original territory. Emmanuel Roman, a 10-year-old boy, wrote a letter, "I'm asking you to return the body parts of the aboriginals to their families. What they did to them were inhumane, removing the hair, brain, and body parts of Chief Encalao. I do not want the remains to be exhibited in a museum. He was a person like you and I. Sincerely yours." His body parts have been resting in Valladateca region since 2014, but I felt that he was still a prisoner. Other sources show that in reality their camps were not in that valley, but on the shores of Nahuel Huapi Lake. Encalao's portrait that is marked by the failure of people functions as a time machine that reminds indignation and impotence. I hope when he took his last breath in those torture halls in La Plata, he saw images of his territory, a free territory. Today, the Mapuche people live on the fringe of the Patagonian cities and in hundreds of rural communities that record each particular reality. Since the conquest of desert, this indigenous ethnic group has struggled to recover the territories stolen by the state in Argentina, or Puel Mapu. As we know the original language, we understand that most of the complaints were made in the provinces of Nacuan, Rio Negro, and Chapat. Before the formation of the states at the beginning of the 19th century, these regions were inhabited by Mapuches, Tehuelches, and other small villages. The Nauquen community of Paisil Antirriao took the first steps to move towards understanding the problems of the land with its protagonists. In 1902, the Argentine state granted the possession of 625 hectares to Lunco Ignacio Antriao on the banks of the Nahuel Huapi and Corrientoso lakes, where Villa La Angostura is currently located. Villa La Angostura is an exclusive tourist center where President Mauricio Macri usually goes there for his vacations. More than 100 years ago, the villa did not exist, and the Argentine state had to consolidate its sovereignty in the place, which is why they officially recognized the ownership of land to those who lived in the place ancestrally. A wooden statue reminds us of Lunco Antirriao, the person who helped the Argentinians during the border demarcation. By consolidating the villa as a touristic paradise, the state began to usurp territory until it occupied 500 out of the 625 of the community's hectares. In 2004, Emmanuel Genabili, NBA World Star, bought 11 hectares inside of community land. Rosa was living here until the millionaire player claimed for the seizure of the territory.
Ginobili fakes, lost it, gets it back, flips it up and flips it in! Exclamation point from Manu Ginobili!
The claim was rejected, but Rosa experienced several eviction attempts. In 1878, the president of Argentina, Nicolas Avellaneda, stated, "Our self-respect as a virile people obliges us to put down as soon as possible, by reason or by force, this handful of savages who destroy our wealth and prevent us from definitely occupying, in the name of law, progress, and our own security, the richest and most fertile lands of the Republic."